This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, why bird-brained ravens are just as smart as chimps, how Tim Peake has been training to run a marathon in space, and we speak to the people who created Sirius Palmyra Arch in London's Trafalgar Square. You're listening to episode 264 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, design, and ravens. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are the Matts. Burgess.
Hello.
And Reynolds.
Hello.
A brief moment of mourning this week for the passing of the Xbox 360.
I'm pretty sad. Well, I've still got one, so I'm fine.
And they will continue to work. They're not all just going to stop. Xbox Live support continues. All this is that Microsoft has announced the end of line for the Xbox 360, which I thought had probably already happened.
No, they've still been around. So I think they updated a version of the 4GB Xbox 360 in 2013. So, you know, they were still kind of like, you know, pulling it along. I think it was launched in 2005. So it's been around a good while.
Sad times. I mean, I still got one at home. I haven't. The only game console I bought since is a Wii U. So I still fire up the old Xbox 360 from time to time, and it's still fine. But I think it's also one of the longest lasting games consoles in terms of its entire life. And you think of the games that have come out. So we've had Assassin's Creed, multiple installments of Halo, Grand Theft Auto, Braid, Dead Space, Far Cry 3. Like it's a pretty amazing games console, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm incredibly behind the pace when it comes to games. I mean, I finished Civilization 4 last year. And I still put games into my 360 and think, wow, this looks fantastic. So I'll be probably very pleased with this for the next 20 years, probably.
The pace of progress has moved beyond you.
Okay, yeah.
A thing that you've learnt this week, Matt Burgess.
Ooh, put on the spot. I've learnt how old the oldest donkey was when it died.
How old was the oldest donkey when it died?
I'm going to make you guess.
Oh, okay. Well, how old would a donkey normally live? Let's say, well, you go, I'll go higher or lower than you.
I'm going to guess that a donkey lives to around mid-40s, so I'm going to say it was 51.
42?
Matt Reynolds is closest, 54. Susie, who died in 2002 in New Mexico.
Way to go, Susie. How old is that for a donkey, do we know?
That's pretty old. It's the longest a donkey's ever lived, so...
Fair point. All right, Matt Reynolds, what have you learnt this week?
So there's this popular urban myth that the Queen owns all swans. But this isn't true. So I found out this week that the Queen only owns unmarked, mute swans in open water. And she actually only exercises that right of ownership on certain patches of the Thames. So it's not all swans. So, you know, let's relearn that fact.
Duly relearned. I learnt... somewhat more alarmingly, that there are 1,648 and counting known asteroids that could potentially present a threat to all life on Earth, including open water unmarked mute swans.
That's terrifying news.
It is absolutely terrifying. And also terrifying this week, Matt Reynolds, you wrote about ravens, and it turns out we should be a whole lot more scared of them than we are already.
Yeah, it turns out we already knew ravens were disturbingly intelligent birds, but they're even cleverer than we first thought, especially for creatures with tiny, tiny, tiny brains. So this week, some researchers from Lund University in Sweden found out that ravens have the same level of self-control that chimpanzees do. And what's interesting about this provides evidence that intelligence doesn't really have much to do with brain size. So I'm going to jump straight in and explain what they did, what these researchers did to find out how ravens are so clever. And so bear with me while I explain the project. It's a bit visual. So they put, in front of a raven, they put some food in a cylindrical tube, an opaque tube. And the ravens knew they were doing this. And this tube had two little holes on either end. And the raven basically had to kind of like peck around and work out how to get the food out. They then repeated this experiment with a completely transparent tube. And basically they were trying to see if the raven would peck at the tube with its beak, you know, getting a sore beak because it's like, oh, wow, the food's there. I go straight through it. Or if they'd be like, oh, no, I know about these tubes because I've seen an opaque one. I'm going to go around the side where the holes are and get the food out. And they found out that 100% of the time, the ravens knew exactly what to do.
So the experiment is essentially testing the self-control of these birds and their ability to reason in order to get what they want.
Yeah, exactly, because on the surface of it, to a less intelligent animal, the quickest route to the food is straight through that tube. But a more reasoned animal that has the self-control not to just go, you know, grabbing for it, would remember to kind of go around the edge. And actually, the ravens completed this, as I said, 100% of the time they got it right. That's exactly the same amount of times that chimpanzees do. And chimpanzees have a much bigger brain than ravens. Their brains are 26 times the size. So this proves pretty conclusively that at least across different species or different genii, in this case, the brain size doesn't link with intelligence.
But is it the fact that people would think that a chimp is more intelligent than a raven because somewhat biasedly they look more like us? So we project our own intelligence onto these animals that look like slightly hairier versions of humans, whereas when you look at a raven or a dolphin, you don't see anything that you can relate to.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. But, you know, we want to put this myth to bed, right? Because we know that actually the corvids, which are the genus that ravens and jackdaws and other birds are part of, are amazingly intelligent. So New Caledonian crows, they don't only use tools, as in poking sticks into logs to get worms out and stuff like that. But one particular female in captivity actually worked out to fashion a hook by herself to pick up a little bucket of treats. So, and you know, that's exactly what a chimpanzee and many great apes can't do. So chimpanzees can use tools, but most great apes can't, and we're seeing exactly the same type of intelligence in these birds.
So it's not just ravens then. You mentioned jackdaws there. Did the researchers try this on other birds, and are other birds just as intelligent, or are the ravens the most intelligent bird?
So other birds, and other birds of this genus, which is corvids, are almost as intelligent as the ravens. So jackdaws are slightly less intelligent. I think the jackdaws... So jackdaws completed the task 97% of the time, which, you know, isn't a bad rate. And the New Caledonian crows, which I said were so clever with their tools, they completed it, I think, I've got the figure here, 92% of the time. And although that seems, you know, not very good compared to the raven, that's much better than bonobos and gorillas, who are other really intelligent great apes.
It's pretty impressive. So next time you see a raven or a jackdaw or a rook, think differently, because that's a clever corvid.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Who knows what they're thinking about you, so watch out for that.
Terrifying. Elsewhere this week, Google has been in some hot water. The search giant has been charged by the European Commission for breaching European Union competition laws. Essentially, they have accused it of abusing its position with its Android operating system. According to officials, Google's overall strategy on mobile devices was to protect and expand its dominant position on internet search. And this included unjustified restrictions that have been placed on manufacturers to prevent competition.
That sounds like a big deal.
It is quite a big deal, but what we find when we run stories like this is there isn't a great deal of public interest in them. So let's try and distill it down into why you should care about this. So according to the commission, Google has a 90% market share across Europe in internet search, licensable smart mobile operating systems, and app stores from the Android mobile operating system. And essentially, this means that you have less choice than you should in a fair market, according to the European Commission. And choice, arguably, is always a good thing.
And did Google have anything to say about these findings?
So somewhat unsurprisingly, Google said, Android has helped foster a remarkable and importantly sustainable ecosystem based on open source software and open innovation. We've kind of been here before. So the European Commission came down very hard on Microsoft for pre-installing Internet Explorer and making that the default browser on Windows. And Microsoft's failure to add what was called browser choice functionality to Windows 7 after a European Commission ruling, this was an error on Microsoft's part apparently, cost it €561 million.
And what about Apple? Because, I mean, a lot of people refer to Apple as a particularly kind of closed, dogmatic operating system environment. Is this in breach of similar laws?
So, according to the European Commission, it would view Android and iOS very differently. So, Apple hasn't been sanctioned by the European Union or investigated by the European Union for this particular anti-competition thing because it doesn't license its operating system to other companies. So, the only phones that use iOS are Apple phones, whereas Android is apparently this open platform onto which anyone can develop. But as the commission pointed out, most people's default browser will be Chrome. Most people's default this, that, and the other will be Google services because Google is, it says, unfairly imposing them on manufacturers and consumers.
So from the commission's point of view, is this just a case of them saying that Google and Android should be more open to more people and people should be able to actually use the systems in the ways they want to?
Yeah, that's essentially it. That's what they did with Microsoft Windows. They opened it up to browser choice, and as a result of that, Internet Explorer's market share absolutely crashed because people all of a sudden discovered that there was Chrome and there was Firefox and there was Opera and there were these other smaller web browsers that fitted very specific needs. So the commission's argument is that when you open a market up to completely free and natural choice, that people are able to make those choices and it becomes more diversified as a result. Microsoft argued against that at the time, and who was the beneficiary? Google. So it would be interesting to see if Google is unsuccessful in its challenge against this ruling. What happens then? Who takes Google's dominant position?
And what in this particular case, what do we know what's coming next?
So Google will have the opportunity to respond to the preliminary findings of the commission. It's got 12 weeks to respond to the allegations, and it's also published a blog post outlining its position on the findings. But as with all of these regulatory things, it's going to take quite a long time. And we're also waiting for similar findings. In April, the European Commission accused Google of unfairly abusing its dominant position in online search. And all told, depending on exactly what is ruled against Google, it could be fined 10% of its annual sales, which is several billion pounds. But we're still awaiting the outcome of that ruling from April, and we're still awaiting the outcome of this preliminary finding made a couple of days ago. So it's a story that's going to take quite a long while to come to a conclusion. Matt Burgess, something that will be happening pretty immediately by the time people listen to this podcast, is the London Marathon. An amazing event, but there's one very special competitor this year.
Yes, there is. It's Tim Peake, the British astronaut who is in space, in the International Space Station. He, along with 38 other thousand people, will be running around London completing the marathon this weekend. And rather than having to face the congested streets with all the other people running and potentially the terrible weather, I think snow's been forecast.
No, it hasn't.
It may not happen, but we'll see. Peake will be completing the marathon from the station's Node 2, which is a compartment of the station, and he'll be using an iPad that shows him running around the course as he goes and updates as he goes along. And he has been training in space since he was sent up there in December, and this has been a particularly grueling challenge for him, and it will be on the day. And there's also somebody in this room that's running the London Marathon, Matt Reynolds. How much training have you been doing?
He didn't even ask if it was me. I could have been doing it too. No one asked. I'm not.
So yeah, it is me, yeah. And how much training have I been doing? So I'm going to say not enough. Obviously, like Tim Peake, very busy schedule, you know, lots of kind of universe supporting experiments I've been running and stuff. You know, I'm hoping a little bit of Dutch courage, I'm not Dutch courage, but a little bit of in the moment on the day. And that's going to get me through those extra, you know, 26 miles. So yeah, not enough training, but I think I keep telling myself it's too late now. So great, you know, carb load. That's what I'm all about.
Well, I've got some good news for you. Tim Peake probably hasn't done as much training as he should have done either.
Oh, great.
But
he's probably done more than you.
Probably.
But that's because he's in space and he is running this marathon on a treadmill. And he's doing that with a backpack, well, basically a backpack, but a harness around over his shoulders, which is holding him down to the treadmill.
So we should make the obvious point that there is no gravity on the International Space Station. So this is one of the biggest challenges for astronauts just keeping fit in space, but now Tim Peake has to run a marathon in space. So this presents all kinds of logistical problems and also health concerns as well, right?
Yeah, so the two bungee cords are attached to to the left and right of him. They're pulling him back down to the treadmill. And this is going to basically mean that he's going to have 60 to even 100% of his body weight going through his shoulders. So this is going to be pulling him down. For each step, he's going to have to sort of go against this. And as he does so, he's going to be like, it's going to be a struggle for him. I've spoken to his personal trainer this week, and he said it's going to be a very hard thing for him to do because he hasn't trained as much as he should have because he's doing all space experiments and lots of different work while he's on board the ISS. So he probably hasn't done quite as much as he should have done.
Yeah, and as I understand it, astronauts aboard the ISS have to follow a very, very strict regimen of exercise to stop their bodies essentially from wasting away. Their bones and their muscles and everything else in their system just starts to not shut down but slow down when there's no gravity. So he's been doing the exercise to counter out that, and now he's all of a sudden got to run a marathon. But not just that, he has to do it all on his own, shut away, without a window.
Yeah, there's no window in this module.
Which just
at all.
Sounds cruel.
It is a little bit cruel, but he's got his iPad, and there's a few other astronauts up there that are going to support him, probably hand him water and some oranges and stuff as he goes along.
You can't eat an orange in space, surely. Maybe some sort of orange gel.
They'll give him something. They'll give him some encouragement as he goes along.
So you spoke to his personal trainer. What did he have to say about the preparation and Tim Peake's hopes for the marathon race?
So Tim has actually run a marathon before, and he's run the London Marathon before. It was a little while ago in 1999, and he obviously had the benefits of gravity then. And he run it in about 3 hours and...
18 minutes?
18 minutes,
50
yeah.
seconds?
Which is pretty quick for...
Very good time, yeah.
A non... professional athlete. That's a pretty good time. And this time he's not going to be quite as fast, but he is aiming for around 3.5 hours to about 4 hours, which he is the first man to ever run a marathon in space, so he will set a record for that. But he has got some competition, because in 2007 the NASA astronaut Sunita Williams completed the Boston Marathon from space in 4 hours and 24 minutes,
which sounds ridiculously impressive. So she was 41 at the time, and flying around the Earth, she was the first person to do this in incredibly difficult conditions. And she did it in a time that will be a lot faster than people who have the slight benefit of gravity.
Yeah, so I spoke to his Tim Peake's trainer, Patrick Jekyll, who has been coaching him through this, who was doing stuff with him before he went to space. And he was saying that when Tim went to space, he was fit enough to do a marathon anyway. But all the work that they've been doing in space, which a lot of it has been around his posture and keeping his strength up, which all astronauts have to do. All astronauts have to do 2.5 hours, roughly, exercise per day. But Tim's work has been, his exercise work has been focused around the marathon, and he's been doing some longer runs at weekends. He's been running more than the other astronauts. So this is what is going to get him across the finish line, really, and hopefully get him across the finish line. But they'll be monitoring his performance from the ground as he's running around, and... well, hopefully he'll do it.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous thing to attempt. You think all the other things that are on your mind and on just on your workload while you're aboard the International Space Station, to take on training for and then running a marathon. And unlike normal marathon runners who probably think, thank God that's over, he can't let up. He has to go back on the treadmill the next day.
Yeah, he has to go back to exercising basically the next day. He'll speak to his personal trainer and have a debrief basically how it went. But because he's coming back to Earth in the next couple of months, he has to keep exercising. His body has to be ready for when he returns to Earth and returns to gravity. Because when astronauts do come back to Earth, and you see this all the time, they can't stand up when they get back because of the effects of not having gravity on their body.
So let's talk a little bit more briefly about the effects of not having any gravity for months at a time. So what are they having to do in space to prevent that? And what are the effects?
So as I said a little bit earlier, every astronaut does exercise in space. There is no astronauts that go to the International Space Station and don't do exercise. It is a part of their routine. It's built into their daily schedules. And if they don't, basically, their bodies try to compensate for not having gravity there, and they can come back with less muscle, less bone, and basically a less efficient cardiovascular system. This is because there is obviously not as much forces acting upon them when they're in space. They don't have to, when they're moving an object, they can just push it around the space station and it will just float around. So basically, because they have to do a little bit less, their bodies also do less.
So Tim Peake is aiming to run it in 3.5 to 4 hours. The record for running a marathon in space is 4 hours and 24 minutes. That's the only time it's been done before. Matt Reynolds, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you must have a time in mind. for yourself.
Well, both of you guys already made me feel like I'm cheating, just so I've got the benefit of gravity. Like, ooh, you know, how dare you not run it in space? So, fine. But, you know, my gravity-assisted time, I'm thinking of going for 3.5 hours. But, you know, we'll see on Monday how I compare with Tim.
So you'll tell us how well you did on the next podcast, and we'll briefly let everyone know how well Tim Peake did, just in case they haven't been checking on the news. But very good luck to you,
thank
Matt,
you.
And up there above our heads, the best of luck to Tim Peake. Still to come, the Islamic State has destroyed historical monuments across Syria, but architects have used digital scans to rebuild the 2,000-year-old Palmyra Arch in Trafalgar Square in London. We'll find out how and why after this.
This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and looking for a simple payment solution, Braintree 3.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more, all with a single integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wirednews. Braintree can't wait to see what you make of it.
Welcome back. Matt Burgess, this was a story you reported this week. So first up, what was... the Palmyra Arch?
The arch was an 1800 to 2000 year old monument that was in the middle of Syria and was destroyed by Islamic State militants last October. And now a 6 meter, 20 foot model recreation of the arch has been created and was unveiled in London's Trafalgar Square this week.
And it looks absolutely amazing. It's quite an extraordinary sight. I was taking the bus past it yesterday, and there it is. And it's going to be going around the world as well. So it's going to be in a few other cities as part of a world tour.
Yeah, so it's going to go to different places around the world, and then it's eventually going to end up back in Palmyra. It's going to be near the site of the original arch, which was destroyed.
Okay, so earlier today, Matt, you sat down with Roger Michael, Executive Director of the Institute for Digital Archaeology, which led the project, to find out more. And you started off by asking him why the arch was rebuilt.
The arch has been a project 2 years in the making. A couple of years ago, when we realized there was an issue with important heritage sites in the Middle East and North Africa being potentially in the way of conflict, we decided to begin documenting those sites. And we had it in mind, even 2 years ago, that there was a possibility, at least in the future, of folks being interested in reconstructing sites that were damaged or lost. And so from the outset, we began to collect these images in 3D form. So over the last 2 years, we've put thousands and thousands and thousands of images from sites throughout the region into our million image database. And then in August of last year, when the Palmyra site was leveled, at least the center of the site, we began to speak to folks in the region and realized there was a huge appetite to have something done, some source of optimism about what the next step would be, replacing some of these structures. Because you have to understand that for people in these cities, just like London after World War II, when they looked and saw their devastated city, the emotional impact, the financial impact of that is almost incalculable. 80% of the GDP in Palmyra, for example, is derived from the historic site. So these are folks now suddenly, apart from everything else that's going on, their livelihood is also taken away. So we began to hear these voices filtering back to us from within the region and realize that even though I think for us the reconstructions had been conceived originally as something down the road, we realized we needed to advance that part of our project. And so we began chatting with some partners in the 3D printing and 3D carving worlds to sort of see what the feasibility of doing this would be. And people, I think, rose to the occasion. It's not easy work, and it's very difficult to produce high-quality recreations of these objects. And fortunately, we found some great partners, in particular, a couple of groups in Italy, D-Shape, that does 3D printing, and TorArt, which does 3D carving. And they were dropped other projects that they had that were already in the pipeline to help us with this, and I think have produced an absolutely superb recreation of this iconic object from Palmyra.
And talking about the reconstruction, you mentioned there that technologies involved include 3D printing and 3D robotics and carving machines. Could you explain briefly how these work and were used in the reconstruction?
The first step, as I said, was to collect the images. Once we have a sufficient number of images for an object, and what we need essentially is high-resolution views of the object, preferably in 3D form, from above, from below, from every angle. Just as an aside, I was very pleased to see in a CBC article that was published the other day, someone who was a resident of Palmyra, really overwhelmed with emotion at seeing this object rise in Trafalgar Square, told the reporter that he had visited the arch on his way back and forth from work frequently back in the day, and he was very curious to see if details that he had recalled from underneath the arch had been faithfully replicated. He said they were all there, and it was great to hear that, great to get that feedback from someone who had that intimate familiarity with the arch, and certainly that's what we were striving for with this recreation. Was complete authenticity. You start with, as I say, 3D images taken from all angles, including below, above, every angle conceivable. We use drones sometimes to capture aerial photography. Once we have a sufficient number of 3D images, we can produce a very high-resolution 3D rendering of the object. And then that digital file can be used to drive either a 3D printer or a 3D carving machine. It's interesting. One is an additive process, the printing process. One is a subtractive process, the carving process. But they're both driven by exactly the same 3D rendering.
And on the wider scale, you've got projects going on around the world where you've got volunteers out capturing these sites. Why is it important these sites, archaeological sites, are actually captured and kept and stored?
Well, I think from the beginning, the Million Image Database was conceived of as a resource for scholars, and we hope that it's going to be we're completely omnivorous. We'll take field notes, images, 3D, 2D photographs, historical photographs, photographs that were taken yesterday. The idea is to produce essentially a Google Earth for World Heritage, a single site that you can visit and ultimately look at all the man-made objects that exist on the surface of the earth around the world. And we hope through social media and through our own efforts, eventually we can become this all-encompassing resource for folks. I think it's really important for scholars to have a place they can look to for reliable materials, a one-stop shopping. But it's also important, I think, for individuals who may not have the ability to travel to some of these sites to nonetheless have the experience of encountering heritage. And so one of the things that we're actively pursuing with Aardman and with others is to create some virtual experiences for folks. That was in the front of our minds. One of the reasons why we began from the outset to collect our images in 3D form, in addition to the possibility for reconstruction, it also holds open the possibility for virtual experiences of these sites. There's a great site in Sicily, Morgantina, and there's a wonderful virtual encounter that you can have when you visit the museum there. And we're talking with the folks who produce that product for the museum in Morgantina, and we're hoping that they'll be able to do the same for some of these sites. So that, I think, will be one of the near-term next steps for us, will be to focus on not just the physical reconstructions, and that's going to be a huge part of what we do. And it was great to talk to Dr. Abdul Karim, who's the antiquities chief from Syria, when he was in London this week, about some possibilities at Palmyra and other sites. But for folks who can't travel to the region, we also want to make these experiences available to them. And so these virtual experiences, I think, will be an increasingly important part of that.
So the whole project really is making the historic artifacts around the world accessible to as many people as possible.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we're living in a time when, throughout history, censorship has been an issue for historians. For folks who care about making sure that prints in the sand that man leaves behind are left unmolested. So look, Nazis burned books. The Russians were airbrushing people out of photographs. These are the ways people in the past have taken steps to rewrite the historical narrative. So I think what's very important for us is to be at the service of the marketplace of ideas. We want to make sure that the history of the world is told in full. And if there are people who have an idea that they can delete selectively portions of the historical record to conform to a social narrative or an historical narrative that suits them, we're here to say that that's not going to happen on our watch. We want to make sure that the historical record remains as complete and accurate as it can possibly be. We hope and sincerely believe that people are working their hardest to make sure this happens, that these objects are preserved on the ground. But to the extent they're not, I think these virtual recreations of these sites could serve a useful purpose in terms of completing an historical record that others are trying to blot out.
And on the bigger picture of digital architecture, what is the landscape like, to use a very bad pun? What is the landscape of that whole area like, and how much is technology involved in architecture these days?
Well, I mean, it's the 3D printing is used now extensively in architecture. Generally, I mean, they've 3D printed bridges, they've 3D printed office blocks, they 3D printed a luxury suite at a posh Las Vegas hotel last year. So there's no question that this is it's called an emerging technology. At this point, sounds a little silly. I mean, it's already here, and you can see it at work in cities around the world. I think it's very important. But when you're talking about building a utilitarian object like an office building, I think people bring a different set of expectations to a project like that. All they care about is the utilitarian value. I think what some folks have said about these historic reconstructions, that is, reconstructions of these ancient sites, is, gee, you know, how does it really, how can it replace an ancient object? These objects have no soul. They haven't endured the they haven't been a witness to the history that has transpired in front of them. So, you know, and I think that's a legitimate concern, and it's one of the things that we spend a lot of time thinking about. It's also one of the things that's a subject matter of the workshops and seminars and lectures that we're offering in tandem with the installation at Trafalgar Square. And I think at least in the Middle East and the Far East, there's a sense that heritage and history is something that resides in the mind. It's something that people carry with them through the generations. And the role of physical objects is to serve as a sort of visual cue for reminding people about history. But the important part of it is what resides in human beings. And I think over time, despite being from the West, where we take a very fetishistic view of objects, what's important to us, I think, sometimes is holding something in our hand and feeling as though we're touching the stone that the master touched. I'm coming around to this different viewpoint. You know, I heard someone say once that there's a saying in the Middle East, it's my grandfather's knife, I replaced the handle, my father replaced the blade, it's my grandfather's knife. What's important about that knife is what it represents in terms of the generational quality of it. The physical object matters very little. It's like the Issei shrine, it's 6,000 years old, but they knock it down and rebuild it every 25 years. But it's an object that at some level exists over the course of 6,000 years, and that's what's important about it. So I think people are right to hold us to a high standard when it comes to recreating historic objects, both in terms of the quality of what we produce, but also in terms of the thoughtfulness of how we produce it and where we cite it and what we tell people about the history of the object. But I can say this, that two things. We've gone to visit the Arch, members of my team and I, Dr. Karanowska from Oxford, who's been absolutely essential to everything that we've done and has managed the project on Trafalgar Square. She and I have visited the Arch the last two nights. Both nights we encountered groups of Syrians who had traveled, expats living in the UK, who had traveled long distances to see the Arch. And they were so emotional about what they saw. It was extraordinary to be there with them. And so that gave me a sense of what kind of spirit something like this can have, just seeing the impact of it in their eyes. And I can also tell you that when I was under the Arch with Mayor Johnson and with Dr. Abdul Karim from Syria, and we all embraced, and I thought about all the people that had been courageous enough to take the photographs that were used to create this object, that had been courageous enough to share my vision to have it appear in Trafalgar Square, to have Dr. Abdul Karim make the effort to come and be with us in London. And as we all embraced, I felt like, my God, we were at that moment infusing this thing with a tremendous spirit. And so these objects do have a soul. They carry the soul of the history of the ages. They carry the soul of the people who care about seeing them recreated in their locality. So I think as people get more familiar with this approach to preserving, conserving, and restoring heritage, they may find that they're surprised themselves at the connection they can feel to even a brand new object.
And what's next for the Arch?
So we had always conceived of showing the Arch in cities, a few cities that we felt like had some connection to the experience of people in Palmyra. So London is itself a reconstructed city. The city lay largely in ruins after World War II. Of course, people didn't wait a minute. They set about the task of reconstructing the city. And when you walk through London today, I think everybody comes here. Indeed, people specifically come to London to be in the presence of history, even though it's a reconstructed city to some degree. So it made a lot of sense, I think, for us to start here in London, because this is a place that I think speaks power powerfully to the potential for reconstructions to embody history. Trafalgar Square was always our number one choice because when you're in Trafalgar Square, you're ringed by all of those classical structures, the colonnade of the National Gallery, the classical features of Canada House, the columns in front of St. Martin in the Fields. And when you see the Syrian object, this iconic Syrian object in the center of all that, and see how it relates to the classical architecture around it, what you realize, what you can't fail to apprehend, is that we're all joined at the hip when it comes to our shared history. All of us go back to the same origins. Our system of government, representative democracy, is ripped straight from Rome. Our literature, our aesthetic sense, it's all something that we share. We have, all of us have in our DNA these roots in antiquity, and that was, I think, a perfect place to make that point, Trafalgar Square in London. It's going to New York City next because, you know, New York City is, needless to say, a city that can, I think and I hope, sympathize with people who have had extremists come into their city uninvited, destroy their architecture, kill their people in the most brutal way imaginable, and yet they are now struggling to and aspiring to set things right. And I think and I hope that New Yorkers will see in the Palmyrans brothers and sisters who have shared a common experience, a tragic one, but nonetheless a common experience. And then we're taking it to Dubai because Dubai is a site in the Middle East, and we knew that we had to bring it back to the region at some point. And also, Dubai is a fascinating place when it comes to people's relationship with architecture. The Emirati are a fascinating and innovative, really an extraordinary group of people that have taken a desert landscape 35, 37 years ago and turned it into this astonishing modern city that reflects the best of everything when it comes to technology and good governance. And they are people that I think care very much about having a place they can be proud of. They are very much connected with the structures in their city. The Burj Khalifa is a tremendous source of pride to people in Dubai. So these are people for whom architecture is incredibly meaningful. They understand the extent to which it's invested with national identity, personal identity. So it really is another ideal spot to bring the arch. And then I will say that Dr. Abdul Karim has very graciously invited us to bring the arch to Palmyra, to have that be the last stop on its trip, and to serve as a memorial to the tragic events that occurred there, but also to remind people of the bond of friendship that exists between people there and people in other parts of the world who have shared their experience and who have taken the trouble to try to do something about it. Needless to say, there are legal and political hurdles to clear. I would need to get permission from my government, from the UK government, to make that happen. But I'm hopeful that given the humanitarian quality of the enterprise, that those permissions would be forthcoming.
So I suppose what this shows is that any artifact, any building, any object can be preserved in this way, and should some harm come to it, could potentially be rebuilt, which is amazingly powerful.
It is, and thanks to modern technology, we can actually preserve things that we may not have in future generations, that whether these are destroyed by people such as terrorist organisations or natural events. So it is really, this sort of project is really storing stuff for the future.
And we should say that it's not going to be hanging around. By the time you listen to this, it will already be gone. 21st of April, it's being taken up from London and off on its world tour, as we said before, eventually resting back in Palmyra in Syria. But if you are in London this weekend, go and watch the marathon and cheer on Matt Reynolds and 37,999 other people taking part. And we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.